Coming up on Boston Public Radio, lots of food and drink talk to prepare you for Mother's Day. But we'll start with chaos on the casino front. Are even gambling supporters having buyer's remorse? Then Corby Cummer and a few Boston chefs winning some big awards, and his and my review of the new Wegmans in Chestnut Hill. Then as corporate America suffers from a woman drain, they're finding ways to lure the best and the brightest back from stints as stay-at-home moms. Globe business columnist Shirley Leung will join us.
Emily Rooney with her famous list and her take on Monica Lewinsky's latest review of her life, this time in Vanity Fair. Lily John on the rage for ramen, the new it food, and our news quiz featuring two local beer experts. The Hopheads go head-to-head on our news quiz. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
In my meteorological role, it will be in the 70s, Saturday and Sunday.
Thank you. I knew you were going to slip in a weather report today because it's
you.
Not a nice day out, is
no,
it?
No, it is not. So it was a big day yesterday at the Mass Gaming Commission, as you know, Marjorie. Here's Commission Chair Steve Crosby's surprise announcement.
Frankly, neither I nor any of the commissioners have any doubt about my ability to be impartial in the decision-making process. But the compounding of these issues has now gotten to the point where my participation in the decision-making process has become a distraction and a potential threat to the critical appearance of our total impartiality.
So Steve Crosby has recused himself from any role in the most important decision, I would argue, the Gaming Commission is going to make, namely picking the casino in eastern Massachusetts. Meanwhile, the remaining four commissioners say they will not consider Marty Walsh's proposal for Boston to get so-called host community status. And the mayor says he may sue. Well, we want to know today, this far into the casino process, does it seem like even supporters of casinos are suffering from buyer's remorse? And I'd include the governor in that, by the way. Has the casino glitz, the glamour, given way to headaches, to uncertainty, and potentially even worse? Our number is 877-301-8970. You can also shoot us an email at bprwgbh.org or tweet us at BOS. Public Radio. And by the way, we should say we invited Commissioner Crosby, who's been with us a number of times before on the show today, but he declined. What a mess yesterday was.
The Herald has got a great picture of Crosby's where he sits. Stephen Crosby, Commissioner, the microphone, and it's just empty. You know, it's sort of a great symbol of the mess this has turned into. It just does seem like another disaster in the state of Massachusetts
and remember,
trying to get anything done.
And this comes on the heels, most recently, of him buying tickets, admittedly, paying himself, bringing his family and I think some friends to a bash, as they call it, at Suffolk Downs. And obviously the relevance of that is that they are part of one of the two casino bids for eastern Massachusetts. The governor, even who named him, even criticized him there. And that came on the heels a while ago of him disclosing 10 or 11 months after he became aware of it that a former business partner and friend of his had an interest in the Everett casino land. And so he is gone, again, only from the eastern Massachusetts decision, but I would argue of the one slot that's already been been issued, the southeast casino and the western Mass casino, eastern Mass is
it's
so far
deal.
And above
no, it's
the most important one.
It's a big deal. But you know what's sort of ridiculous about this? First, he was biased for the casino in Everett because this guy he had business relations with a long time ago.
Yeah.
I thought that was rather a big nothing, actually.
I didn't think it was a big nothing.
I did.
Why didn't he disclose
well,
it 10 months earlier?
He probably should disclose earlier, but you might say he didn't disclose it 10 months earlier because he too thought it was a big nothing. But anyway, he's supposedly biased in favor of Everett because his buddy's going to make some money off the casino land. Then he's biased towards Suffolk Downs because he's over there at this big party.
Going he left one out, by the way. And Caesars, which was dropped by the original Suffolk's bid in East Boston, has a lawsuit pending against
them. You know, it's all over the map. But the thing that was really odd, and I don't understand it at all, why Steve Crosby, who by all accounts is a very, very smart guy, would have thought for a nanosecond that it was okay to show up at a Kentucky Derby Day party at Suffolk Downs. It's just
right
ridiculous.
Before the by the way, close to the decision on host community status, which was made yesterday. And by the way, if those don't understand host versus surrounding is what Boston is getting, much to the dismay of Marty Walsh. Host would have allowed Charlestown to vote on the Everett Casino and veto it if it chose to, and East Boston to vote on the casino in Riviera. Our number is 877-301-8970. How are you feeling about the casino thing? We're a couple of years into the legislation. We are potentially just months away from the voters of Massachusetts in November voting on whether or not to repeal the law. Obviously, that is dependent upon a decision from the state's highest court, which we expect to get at the end of June. Literally, people may be able to roll this whole thing back. While the most recent poll I've seen, Marjorie, a majority of people in Massachusetts supported the casino law, it's a dwindling majority. It's down to 55, and that's before this mess with the recusal of the gaming chair here and Marty Walsh probably, I'm guessing, today, Monday, Tuesday, filing a suit against the commission.
Marty Walsh is going to get a lot more money if there is a casino in Everett or Suffolk Downs. That's presuming, of course, that we don't get rid of the whole shebang and the ballot question in November to say get rid of these casinos altogether. Marty Walsh is going to get a lot more money from Boston. I mean, that's obviously what his endgame is.
You're saying from the casinos?
Yes. Yeah. He wants a lot more money, and he probably is going to get it if there is a casino in either city.
You mean via negotiations with each of the with the winning casino?
That's what this is about, of course. More money for Boston?
Well, no, but Orton, I'm not sure it is. We asked him that question. It is conceivable that his end game is not more money. His end game was and is allow Charlestown to kill the casino in Everett, allow East Boston to kill the casino in Revere. That means the Gaming Commission has to start all over, and maybe Boston gets a casino. If you remember correctly, his view, we asked him this during the debate you and I moderated, do you support a yes vote on a casino in East Boston? And while he danced with us in the next debate with R.D. Sewell, he said, yes, I am urging the people of East Boston. He wanted a casino within the confines of the city of Boston.
The Globe has an interesting last paragraph to its editorial today talking about Crosby recusing himself. It points out that Governor Patrick criticized Chairman Crosby for attending this party, this Kentucky Derby Day party at Suffolk Downs. But it also points out that it was Governor Patrick who signed a law putting the same person, Crosby, in charge of regulating horse racing at Suffolk Downs and deciding whether the track gets the casino license that it desperately wants. So that's a good point, too. That's a weird provision in the law that you're in charge
of. Jurisdiction is as broad as that?
Yes.
Okay. Our number is 877-301-8970. There's another complicating factor here. People were asking immediately after Steve Crosby made his recusal announcement, is that enough? Does that cure the problem, taking him out of the decision-making in eastern Massachusetts? Well, I asked that kind of question of a lawyer last night on my television show on NECN. His name is Michael Rubin. His expertise is conflict of interest. Listen to what he had to say.
The governor calls you on the phone and says, okay, Michael, you have some expertise here. Fix this mess. How do you fix it?
You start from scratch.
Appoint a new gaming commission?
Take new bids from new
potential casinos?
You're going to have to start the process all over again. It's tainted beyond where any taxpayer is going to feel comfortable with the process that's been used up until this point in time.
And by the way, I don't know Michael Rubin terribly well. I know of Michael Rubin, and I've interviewed him a couple of times. He's not exactly a flame-throwing kind of guy. This is pretty dramatic. He is saying, Margie, what a lot of people said about the medical marijuana dispensaries. It is too screwed up. Let's start the process all over again. Obviously, the governor chose not to do this. The governor, by the way, will be with us next week, and obviously some of these things will come up.
Well,
but that's a secondary question for you all out there. Is the process been so tainted by all of these issues that maybe they just have to go back to square one and start
over? Well, if Governor Patrick ever does run for higher office, and many people think he's going to down the road, this is all going to hurt him. I mean, you have this totally botched casino process. You have a totally botched, so far, medical marijuana signing process. You have a totally botched DCF, and you have a totally botched health connector.
Well, I would say on that list, by the way, the only one I would agree with is this DCF. You can't undo the damage that was done to people like Jeremiah Oliver. Mm-hmm. If the casinos are up and running or the voters repeal them, that's the story, not the process. Same if the dispensaries are open and running well, that's the story. And if the health connector, if the website is working well, I think that's the story.
Yeah,
today,
a lot of things to be botched at one time in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We just have a good email from Christopher who suggests that maybe what they do is put the casino down the Cape in Mashpee right near the Crafts House. Let's put it next to the oyster farm.
You might want to explain what the issue
is. The Crafts are upset about. Well, Christopher's referring to the fact that the Crafts are, we shouldn't say the Crafts, but maybe people that had the same interests as the Crafts did in putting a kibosh on this oyster farm outside Pompanisset, where the Crafts have a summer home. They slipped this piece of legislation into Beacon Hill, much to the surprise of the legislators that represent Pompanisset. In any case, he's making a joke, Christopher is, that the Crafts don't want the oyster bed. They probably don't want the casino either, but maybe that's the place to cite it.
877-301-8970. I would guess that if there was a poll taken this morning statewide based on the news, the 55% approval would probably be beneath a majority. The casino proponents are going to spend a lot more money than the opponents. But this is going to – we've asked virtually every political panel we've had in here. This is going to be center stage come the November election, regardless of who the Republican and the Democrat are. It's going to be a – the only Democrat, to my knowledge, who is outright opposing – casinos, I think, is Don Berwick, who I'd say is fairly unlikely to be the nominee. Who knows? The convention is in June, primaries in September. Charlie Baker has taken the position he believes the voters should be entitled to cast a ballot. He's for the SJC putting the question on the ballot, unlike the leading Democrat, Martha Coakley, who you recall is the reason the case is before the SJC, because she ruled as Attorney General that the question couldn't appear on the ballot. So this issue is far broader than just do we get three casinos plus a slots parlor. It may determine who the next governor of the Commonwealth is.
And I've said this a million times.
Say it again.
But I think it's worth saying one more time. I think the problem in Massachusetts for the casinos is that when these casinos were brought up as an idea, we were in the depths of the recession.
It
was right after the crash, 2008, 2009, people were worked up into a frenzy about, you know, foreclosures and people losing their jobs and there not being jobs. So this was pushed as a big jobs bill. And I think, what is it now, 2014, so that's six years later. We're not – the economy is not great, obviously, but I don't think people are in that panic mode they were.
Well, it passed 2.5 years ago. But, yeah, I think that's a very valid point, and which may explain – Shirley Leung, who's joining us in a few minutes to talk about her column this morning about women, people who went home as mothers and took a leave, essentially, from being in the workforce about – getting restarted in the workforce. She wrote a piece a few days ago, is Deval Patrick all in on casinos? Her assertion is he's not so crazy about it. And I think also the governor, and he'll speak for himself next week with us, his language has changed in terms of his support for this. And while he says he still supports it, my guess is if there was a sodium pentothal test for all of the casino supporters on Beacon Hill, and the question was if you had a choice to have a do-over and vote again, my guess is that they wouldn't have done this to begin with. But who knows? Ryan, you're in Newton, New Hampshire, by the way, where a casino vote was defeated by one vote in the House of Representatives the other day. Ryan, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Ryan.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. Thank you.
Good. I want to talk about the money issue. And this, I'm a huge supporter of the New Hampshire Rebellion thing, which is a whole movement to get money out of politics.
Yep.
And I think this applies here. I think anytime you have too much money involved, you're going to have people who are more concerned about the money than the actual project. And you see that with dispensaries a lot, and they're not really concerned with patient care and the actual thing that it can provide. They're more concerned about the money behind it. And I think it's the same with the casinos. I think that sometimes you need to filter out people in order to get new people who are more excited about the project than the fund.
Well, also, it's not just in the casino world, it's not just those who run the casinos it's a private venture. They're entitled to make as much money as they can within the bounds of the law. It's obviously legislators, as Marjorie said before, in a recession, who saw easy money, and it didn't have the T word, the dreaded T word, taxes connected to it, let people just go gamble their money away. And so I think you make a good point, Ryan. Thank you much for the call. You know, that's what's always lost. When pro-casino people say, legitimately, this is hundreds of millions of dollars, even though I think the estimates are wildly overblown in Massachusetts, but it's a significant amount of money. To raise $100 million, just to pick a number, you know what has to happen? Someone has to lose $100 million. That's going to be people in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Connecticut, wherever it is. The only way you win, as with lottery, is if somebody loses.
Let's go to Don in the car. Hi, Don.
Hey, Don.
How you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, no, I like the topic. I live in East Boston. I don't think it makes sense to put a casino like right in the middle of a community. Same with Charlestown. Traffic is crazy. The infrastructure is not here with the roadways. I know that's been many, many debates. But, you know, it makes more sense to put this casino over near the convention center. There's acres and acres of land over by the shipyards behind the design center.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the hotels over there. They need more hotels for the convention center. And they have the land over there. It's right on the waterfront. It makes more sense to put it out of the way of these communities that have three family houses, people living on top of each other, 3 feet away from each other. It just doesn't support it. You know,
I have two words for you, though, Don. Football stadium. Do you remember when there was a proposal a decade or so ago when Bob Kraft, Robert Kraft, Mr. Kraft wanted to have a football stadium instead of in Foxborough, but in South Boston? Was it Jimmy Kelly who was then the city councilor?
Yes.
The people of South Boston rose up, and I think the fear was, just like your neighbors in East Boston said a big fat no to a casino in your community, that was you that as an outsider may say yes, but they probably would have said no. Don, thanks for the call.
Do you even remember, was there any talk at all of putting the casino in the waterfront in South Boston? I don't recall it either. But I mean,
there is a lot of space, by the way, by the marine terminals down there. But again,
of course, it could all be underwater.
That's true. But 877-301-8970. I would say it was a bad day yesterday for casino supporters. You've got a very angry mayor who, I think, to show that he means what he says, has gone to file a lawsuit about this thing. So it'll be one more lawsuit. And by the way, based upon the history, based upon Crosby's historical relationship with a guy who was a part owner of the land in Everett, even though he's now recused himself. And by the way, he recused himself from the land decision once that came out as well. I'm assuming that if Revere got it instead of Everett, if Everett got it, the Revere people would sue, saying obviously has a relationship with the Revere, with the Everett landowner, or at least did have a relationship. And the flip is the case. I said this the other day. I don't know who we were talking to here, Marge. I don't think there's going to be a casino in eastern Massachusetts, regardless what happens, for years and years, even if people reject the repeal on the ballot. There's going to be litigation.
You know, it's
like a full employment act for lawyers.
How many commissioners are there? Is it four?
Five now for eastern Mass.
So how weird is it that you're making the most crucial decision, and the guy that's the chairman, and there's only five of them, is gone?
Well, there's another part to that.
I mean, that's bizarre. It's like if you were doing something in your company and the CEO was not there for the most crucial, important decision there. What's he going to do? Is he going to go back to his house and play solitaire?
As he did yesterday when they were making the decision on host versus surrounding community, left. But there's another issue, which is where I thought you were going. What is four?
That's a very good point.
How do you divide four into two?
I don't know.
If two vote for Everett and two vote for Revere, what happens then?
They'll have to call Governor Patrick.
And by the way, Peter Howe asked that question from NECN yesterday, and the answer was they keep talking. They keep talking and talking and talking and voting until they break the logjam. Sort of like an overtime game, I guess.
Maybe they could just draw straws
Stanley Cup.
Do it that way.
877-301-8970. The rollout has not been smooth, let's put it that way.
Mary from Milford. What do you think, Mary?
Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would just like to say that I'm feeling pretty smart right now because we kept them out of Milford.
You did vote against it, right?
Oh, are you kidding? I carried a sign and marched back and forth on Main Street.
How big was, I can't remember, Mary, how big was the vote against the Milford location?
Well, I think it was 65-35, but not one precinct wanted it.
Well, you know, now that it's not going to be in Milford, you're the perfect person to talk to. You didn't want it in your backyard. That's the classic, as people say, NIMBYism, not in my backyard. But if there was a vote in November as to whether or not the law would stand, with an understanding that by virtue of your vote there will never be one in Milford, would you vote to repeal the law or allow the law since you wouldn't get a casino?
Wow. I'm not too sure about that. I don't really know much about it, but I can tell you that my objection to it was the thousands of drunk drivers that it would bring with it.
Well, that's a wonderful reason for a vote, Mary. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, that is a good point. I don't know what it's like in casinos all around the country, but it is a weird thing when I went to the ones in Connecticut where people are getting served drinks right at the slot machine. It can cause big problems, needless to say.
And we should say, based upon the local referendum right that was exercised, East Boston was able to reject it. But we should say, in the spirit of balance and fairness here, the people in Everett, 80-some percent said we want it. The people in Revere, I think by somewhere in the mid-60%, a landslide there, said they want it, but obviously it has an effect on surrounding communities. And also, there's a whole issue about the culture. One of the reasons why people think that people like Sal DeMacy oppose this was not just because he didn't want one. Where does he live? In East Boston or wherever he lived, Charlestown, I guess. But because it changes the culture of a community,
Sal
of a
DeMacy,
state
North
kind
End.
Of thing.
North End.
North End, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, don't they have a condo? Wasn't the condo that's in question in Charlestown? I don't know where it is. In any case, let's go take a couple more calls if we can. Ray, you were in the car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Ray.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'd like to start off by saying I love the yin and yang between you guys.
Who's yin and who's yang, though, Ray?
I am not taking that side.
I think I'm yang.
Thank you, Ray. What's up?
Well, I'm feeling a bit redundant because Mary kind of touched on my not in my backyard comment.
Yep.
I really think that, you know, if they came to my town, my first reaction would be to wait till my property value spiked, sell the house, and get the hell out.
Mm.
Because I certainly, you know, to her point, the traffic would be a nightmare, the drunks would be a nightmare, just the whole drain on the local resources would be tough. Also, and to an earlier point, you know, this whole thing about making the commissioner or having the commissioner step down, you know, that's, like you say, that's much ado about nothing. I really think that it's a tempest in a teapot that he paid for his whole family to go to a party in a place where they already voted the thing out.
What's well, except let me just say, but I've known Steve Crosby for a very long time, and I've always had positive feelings about him, so I'm not suggesting he's some corrupt character. I think he made a mistake because there is a real serious appearance issue, and I'll tell you why. Let's assume you live in Everett, and you want that casino badly. You're one of the 80-some percent. And a month, and I'm making up the timeline, a month after he goes to a lush party at Suffolk Downs, he paid his own $50 a head, but at a lush party with an open bar and all this sort of thing, he votes for Revere. You tell me, if you sit there, you're not at least going to say to yourself, well, wait a second. He was accessible to all of the pro-Revere people. And even if, as you say, and as Marjorie said, there's not much ado about anything there, the appearance is what's the problem. And I think that's why he decided he had to recuse himself, because the appearance, frankly, Ray, I think is not good at all. But thanks for your call. We appreciate it. And thanks for your kind words.
That's the answer I want. What was he thinking when he...
He's a really smart guy.
Smart guy, and I think he's very well respected.
Also, I think you're far too generous on this thing about the Everett land, where he ultimately recused himself from that vote as well. You're saying why? He didn't want to disclose it because he didn't think it mattered? When you say to yourself...
They were in business like 20 years
before that. Marjorie, you're about to make a decision. You're about to write a column about somebody, and it's somebody you were a roommate with at college or on a trip 20 years ago, and you're going to write a piece about that person. You wouldn't disclose in that column, oh, by the way, I went to Europe with Jane Doe 15 years ago.
I don't think it was a brilliant thing, but I don't think it was a disqualifying
thing. It's an appearance of partiality. The issue. I'm not saying it's a disqualifier.
But to believe that, you would have to believe that he was going to put his entire credibility on the line to make a lot of money for a guy he knew 20 years ago that he hadn't really been.
You remember what the issue was until I asked him the question on TV? Mm-hmm. The word around town, at least in the media community, was, well, wait a second, he and this guy allegedly invested in the struggling cable TV guide business, I think that's the right business, of Steve Crosby. What were we all saying? Well, if it turns out he rescued a sinking business and made it profitable, isn't there a repayment issue? Now, Crosby on my show said he did not make a nickel off that that venture. That doesn't raise an issue about repayment without that
Jim,
answer?
Let me put it this way. Sometimes you obsess over things that the average citizen does not quite get
so
worked
up
about.
No, by the way, you usually obsess on this stuff, too.
I'm obsessed about the party. Whole notion of the party.
Well, fine. Wait a second. The party is of more concern to you
than
having a business relationship with a man who's going to profit from a land transaction?
Because it speaks to a rather odd lack of judgment and understanding about appearances.
Exactly.
Which is different than this thing that was 20 years ago. But you can obsess over what you want to obsess about, Jim.
I think obsess is probably too strong a word.
Not obsess.
Maybe it's not too strong a word. Actually, on reflection, it's not
You've been
too
talking about this for 3 days.
I have. I'm obsessed.
All right. Enough of this. Up next, Boston won big at the James Beard Awards for a town whose nickname is derived from dreary baked beans. Does this signify a turning point for our city's culinary stature? Corby Cummer joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We see one of the last performances by the late actor Philip Seymour Hoffman in the new movie God's Pocket.
To see the making of, on a day-to-day basis, one of those performances is really pretty astonishing.
A conversation with filmmaker and Mad Men actor John Slattery later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
this afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com. And the Lowell Institute, sponsoring free public lecture since 1839, including Defense Technology and Implications for Global Security, May 13th, presented by World Boston at the Boston Public Library. More at lowellinstitute.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Boston, a town whose best known restaurants were once Brigham's and Boston Market, has ascended from, they were my favorites too, has ascended from the ranks of dumpy fare to a dining destination on a par with LA, New York, Chicago. Here with us to talk about the town's latest culinary achievements and his initial visit to Wegmans and mine at Chestnut Hill is Corby Kummer. Corby, as you know, is an award-winning food writer, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and we learned last week he votes on the Tony Awards. How are you, Corby?
I'm great. How are you?
Great to see you.
So they call these James Beard Awards like the Oscars of the food awards, and Boston did do pretty well, did we not?
No, Boston did fantastically well, matter of fact. So not only did a chef who, see, I'm also Boston Magazine's restaurant critic, so that is why I get to go to all these restaurants in Boston and be quite as up on the scene as I am. So we've been watching Jamie Bissonette wait. This is the progress of the Beard Awards. There's a long runway. It takes a couple years. And 2 years running, Jamie Bissonette, who learned meat with Ken Oringer when he opened KO Prime, which was a steakhouse at 90. Then he opened Toro, the great tapas place, with Ken Oringer. Right now, since the fall, he's been a displaced Bostonian in New York, opening a giant branch of Toro right next to a Mario Batali restaurant called Del Posto.
Oh, my goodness. A little competition.
Well, huge competition. And Del Posto is like one of the fanciest restaurants in New York with a great chef named Mark Ladner, who one day will win a Beard Award. So Jamie's been away, but now he's coming back to Boston, maybe because of the award, maybe not. But we are very lucky he's coming back. He's so good with meat. And when he opened Copa, it's my favorite of the Ken Oringer, Jamie Bissonette, other collaborator restaurants. Copa in the South End, great Italian food, world-beating meatballs, rustic Southern Italian pastas with really lusty, peppery tomato sauces. Yeah, everybody has to go to Copa. So it's really for his work at Copa that he's been nominated for the Beard Awards, and he's a really good guy. So 2 years running, he showed up dressed up. His dad from my hometown of Hartford came every time. This time he came a third time, and third time's the charm, and he watched Jamie win. I thought that was such a great moment.
And Barbara Lynch did pretty well down there, too, yes.
Barbara Lynch didn't do pretty well. Barbara Lynch took what is, in a way, the top award. It's called Outstanding Restaurateur. Don't put that extra N in. And it's Restaurateur. It's from the French word for restore. And what it means is business entrepreneur. And that's what Barbara is brilliant at, as well as having pretty impeccable taste, both visually and in food. She's a really smart, tough-as-brass businesswoman.
Really?
Barbara?
I've never met her.
Barbara. Yeah, you don't want to be on the wrong side of Barbara.
And this is number 9 Park.
Or Marjorie, by the way.
This is number 9 Park, right across the street.
Yeah,
I'm a real tough businesswoman, Jim. That just captures it all. This is right across the street from the State House, right? Number 9 Park.
So number 9 Park is what she first came to prominence right down the street on Park Street, facing the Common at Galleria Italiana, where she cooked fantastic pastas with two Italian women who were great Boston restaurateurs themselves. Then she opened Number 9 Park. She turned it into a local destination. She herself is a great story. She grew up in the projects. She taught herself cooking. She was on a cruise ship around Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. They suddenly needed a cook, and she taught herself. There's nothing she
can't
do.
I didn't know that. That is a great story.
Which projects?
South Boston.
Well, she's Steve Lynch's congressman's cousin, is she not? Isn't
they're
she
related.
Lynch's cousin?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know if it's cousin, but they're related.
So when you mentioned Barbara Lynch, what's the state of women in the restaurant and chef hierarchy? Well,
so they're never prominent enough. It's too much of a men's game, as a lot of women will tell you. I got to go to the Hip Chef's annual world conference in Copenhagen called MAD. MAD is actually slang for food in Danish. Who knew? But they all, you know, they all have tattoos. They all think they're very cool and eccentric, and they are. These guys, and they were criticized for not having enough women on the program. And Barbara was there, kind of representing womanhood at this International Chefs Conference. And she came on, and the theme was awful, as in secondary cuts, OFFAL. And it was guts in general. And she came on and she talked about having guts as a businesswoman and having a pair of part of male anatomy that was larger than most of the men there. And she made it clear that the kind of tough decisions she had made throughout her life and business career meant she had to have a very thick skin and she had to have really sharp business acumen. The award she got is for somebody who opens many successful restaurants. So that's what she does. She's able to pick talent. She can keep talent. She's got B&G Oysters, the butcher shop. She loves artisanship. She loves typography and beautiful design. Menton, her restaurant in the waterfront, is like the most luxurious restaurant in Boston. It sets standards. She wants to go up against Per Se and the French Laundry and the national leaders. She's really got guts and ambition.
Does she have children?
Yes.
So she's been able to do this with raising the family.
Yes, she does.
That was one of my theories about women chefs, is that it's very difficult because the hours, it's very demanding hours to run restaurants.
But she was cited for having her 3-year-old peel potatoes in one of her restaurants. You remember that, Corby,
a couple of years ago?
It's true.
So where I was going with this was not only the rise of women in the restaurant and chef business or industry. They won a ton of awards, Beard Awards, this round. Did they not? Am I wrong about that?
You're not at all wrong. Women have always done well. Anna Sorten, who I think is Barbara Lynch's same age, and I think they had kids at exactly the same time, and they're very close friends and have been mentors to each other. It's a great friendship. She won Best Outstanding Chef Northeast for Beard quite a while ago. Women certainly win every year here and there, but this year they kind of swept the top awards. So the country's outstanding chef, which very seldom, gosh, if ever, no, Alice Waters has gotten it, but very few women have gotten it. And it went to Nancy Silverton in Los Angeles, who with Mario Batali opened Mozza and two other restaurants that are incredibly hot and incredibly good. And as my friend Ed Levine of Serious Eats, a website, and himself a terrific food writer, said, she has perfect food pitch.
Oh,
that's a great
so
line.
It is such a good. I had to tweet it out right away.
And
so
Joanne Chang, one of our favorites, was nominated for something, wasn't she?
She's going to get it. She was nominated for Outstanding Chef in the Northeast, showing that pastry chefs can be nominated for the Regional Chef Awards. And
awesome.
I want her to get it.
She's and by the way, from Flower and Myers and Chang, for those who.
So is the thing with women, was it a previous just sexist bias against women as chefs, or were there not that many, or why none that, you know, years ago and so many now?
So I think you often have Joanne on this show, and you should ask her. But yes, I think that women will always tell you it's very hard to rise in the chef world. They're considered not to have the stamina. If they want to have children, they're just not going to be there the hours that men work. There's this ingrained prejudice against women in kitchens. It's very hard for professional women.
Speaking of men in kitchens, which we weren't, but I want to talk about just for once. When you mentioned tattoos a minute ago, I had no idea why.
I know you were going to say that.
You don't know where I'm going.
Yes, you do.
My favorite television show without a close second. Well, that's actually not fair. My favorite CNN show, or one of my favorite CNN show, is Anthony Bourdain. I love Anthony Bourdain. We interviewed him about a year ago. One of the sweetest interviews we've probably ever done. We all know him as a television star. I assume you knew him as a chef.
I knew him as a writer.
And he was a chef, was he not?
Sure.
How is he regarded as a chef in his earlier life?
He was kind of middle of the road. That wasn't his strength. His strength was his observational skills and his incredible writing. Yeah. I remember when New York Magazine bought first rights to Kitchen Confidential, and then I think somehow got trumped by The New Yorker after New York Magazine when I was their restaurant critic. Everybody was excited about him. He was this fresh, incredibly cynical, cool voice. He gave rise to a whole raft of chef memoirs and the idea of the tough chef persona.
Yeah.
You know, punk rock musician, ex-drugs, incredible hours, tough stamina. He's a great writer is what I like
and
best
And he's great
about
on
him.
Television. I mean, he's just a natural host on that television show. The reason I thought you were going to mention the tattoos was we were talking yesterday about whether you can get a job if you're tattooed in places that are visible. I just want to point out, apparently it does not interfere with your job as a chef because Jeremy Bissonnette looks almost like he's got flames coming up his neck underneath
his
T-shirt.
So he does, but we were both at the Community Servings Lifesaver last night, mm-hmm. a great annual benefit.
Yeah.
I am a founding board member. Marjorie,
I did not know that.
Was there, yeah.
Yeah, I was there too.
So I saw lots of people in formal wear with tattoos, like women on the nape of their neck,
yes.
men on their neck or on their arms. It seems to be just accepted. And I don't know how accepted it is in the white collar world, but in this very dressy event last night, there were plenty of tattoos on both men and
women. There were plenty of tattoos.
You know, let me tell you where I didn't see any tattoos midweek because it was pretty much like an AARP convention. After Corby was here, Corby Cummer from The Atlantic and Boston Magazine he and I arranged after he was here last week, you were off, Marjorie, that on Sunday we would go to Wegmans together. It wasn't the opening day, but we'd go and together. And unfortunately, I couldn't. So you did. I went a few days later. Middle of the day, middle of the week is obviously a senior citizen kind of moment. That's why it was AARP-like. So we wanted to get your review, and I'll give you a minor one of mine. What was your take on this celebrated Wegmans coming to Chestnut
so
Hill?
So I really want your review because mine is going to be so mixed. First, it took 10 minutes to find a parking spot, which, you know, didn't endear me to them. But as a friend of mine from Newton wrote, so park in the front of the lot. You can walk in. It won't kill you, Corby. And I felt so shamed because, of course, you know, I didn't realize there's a whole other side. There's a huge lot there. Yes, you can walk and it won't kill you. And they had lots of guys in orange jackets they had hired just to try to direct traffic. But, you know, all those senior citizens weren't moving so fast in their cars. So it's differently arranged from most supermarkets. I was about to say confusing, but I think if you're used to a Wegmans arrangement, you wouldn't be confused. You said you'd heard it was dark, Marjorie, last week. And indeed, I found it dark. Low ceilings and dark. That surprised me. I'm going to want your opinions, Jim. But the produce, the organic, was on a completely different wall from the conventional. It was hard to figure out, so what have they got that's conventional? What have they got that's organic? Because I always go for organic first. And some of it, they don't have all the pre-cut stuff next to the whole stuff. It's hard to see. They'll have like apples or beets or carrots or something three different ways in three completely different places. So you have to figure out, so which do I want? And I know that there's got to be a method to that madness, but I couldn't figure it out. So I think that with any new supermarket, it takes a while to figure it out. Then what surprised me is that the dry goods aisles in the middle are set up like a big box store. You know, so it's all like this wire shelving and the idea you're going to get great value. I'm sure you do. I didn't compare prices. But in what I'd heard was such a high-end supermarket, that was incongruous to me. So I've got to get used to it. Okay, Jim.
Now, wait a second. You started this, Corby Cummer. You do this for a living, saying it was a mixed review. I didn't hear a mix at all. What's
all right,
the positive?
All right, so the mixed is there were like four artisan cheeses and then a lot of prepackaged pre-cut cheeses. That's not what I like to see. Mm-hmm. I like to see a lot of individually aged cheeses.
What'd you like the most?
That are unusual. What did I like the most there? Some of the pre-cut vegetables in the dairy case. I always go straight for the dairy case to see what the variety is. They had their own house brand of various yogurts and half and half and cottage cheese and cream cheese. That, you know, I always like seeing that when it's organic and house brand. I liked some of the produce, but I didn't like it as much as I wanted to.
This is a pan, I would say, of Wegmans.
It's a mixed pan.
It's mostly a pan.
I have to go back and try the prepared foods.
Well, it's funny you should say that.
Mr. Hot Bar over here.
Excuse me, it is not Mr. Hot Bar. My nickname in the building is the Prince of the Hot Bar.
Excuse me.
I wear that well.
The honorific, please.
Yes. Let me be fair here, because I would assume you feel the same way about restaurants. I was there for 15 minutes because I was on the run. Uh-huh. So I'm going to give it a second and a third chance because people do rave about this every time we've talked on the radio. I felt sort of mixed as well. I like restaurants and supermarkets where it feels right You know, as a, you were talking content and the merits, I can't speak to that. You want the feel to be something where you're totally comfortable. I went right to the hot bar because I don't know if I told you I'm the prince of the hot bar. Did I tell you that? Oh, yeah.
I hear you're the prince of the hot bar.
Thank
Jim.
You. I know that's the word on the street. They were, you know, the food was in little plastic, cheapy little vats kind of thing, which I didn't like to begin with. The selection was okay, but not great. And I think part of the problem is, let me end my mixed review because I'm going to come back in a few weeks with another one, is when your expectations are so high. I don't know if this is a problem with you when you're doing restaurants and things like that.
Where's the other one? Northborough?
Northborough's. Burlington. Isn't there a Burlington's?
Rave reviews from people that went to the one in Northborough.
Yeah, right.
So but the bottom line is you when you go there, you think you're about to have almost an orgasmic supermarket experience. And when it doesn't live up to that, maybe that was what my disappointment was. Oh, before you go, by the way, I don't know if we ever told you this before. When Marjorie and I were in a prior radio station, we decided we were going to do something very clever. Mm-hmm. We were going to go make a video
at
the brand new Wegmans in Northborough. Remember I told you about this?
No, you told me you did an hour show on
Okay, fine. So we did do an hour show. But in any case, I drive out to Northborough, which took me about 4 hours. I get there. Our production crew goes out there, too. And it's beyond my – I mean, I don't travel that far ordinarily. I got to Northborough. Our production crew is there. And we're ready to start filming. And there's one small – and the manager greets us, plays one small problem I haven't told you. It's Marjorie wasn't there yet. So we say to the manager, she'll be here in 5 minutes. We wait 5 minutes. We make 20 minutes. We set up the cameras. We have a routine we thought was going to be funny. About an hour later, the manager was growing somewhat impatient. She said, basically, call me when your person shows up. So we've been calling Marjorie repeatedly. And the end of the story, of course, is Marjorie eventually picks up the phone. I said, how many minutes away are you after I said something inappropriate? And she said, well, there's a small problem. I fell asleep in the parking lot at our radio station. And she was the same 4 hours away that I was.
Well, you're not explaining.
The video that all of Eastern Massachusetts was waiting for. What?
Let me just explain.
What's that?
We used to have to get up at like 3:30 or 4 in the
morning. I got up the same time you did,
and my routine was after the show to take a nap, usually in a parking lot somewhere, and turn off my telephone. And alas,
you're a famous car napper.
She is
a car napper.
So my alarm did not go off, and I missed the whole Wegmans, and it was a very humiliating experience.
There's something I have to.
Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's something I have to mention about Wegmans. I met a guy I knew very well from a rival, very high-end supermarket here. He said when he went to Northborough, he was so impressed by their customer service that he came back. He gave suggestions based on that. He didn't feel he was listened to, and so he has gone to work for Wegmans, and he said he's never seen customer service like theirs. My spouse, John, met a number of service people from Upper New York State, which is the headquarters,
Rochester,
who said that Wegmans had brought them in to train the new staff, had put them up in a very nice hotel. They were really enjoying their time here. So that kind of attitude from the top and care about employees is bound to flavor your whole experience.
Well, before you go, let me just say,
you know,
I should have said this.
Free samples for you at the hot bar.
I just took the samples.
Don't you think?
By the way, not only were the people great, I should have said that in my mixed review when I went the other day. We had someone call last week who's worked there. What did she say? She'd worked there 20 years at different Wegmans.
Yes.
Loved the place. Changed her life. Blessed place she ever worked. So I will return, and I assume you will,
of
Corby.
Of course,
at some
many
point
times.
There. Corby Cummer, it's a pleasure to see you as always.
Pleasure
thank
to be
you.
Here.
Thank okay, you. Thank you very much, Corby Cummer. Corby Cummer is, of course, an award-winning food writer and a senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks again, Corby. Up next, Boston Globe business writer Shirley Leung talks about the women brain drain from the workforce and what companies are doing to woo them back. That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
E.T. Phone Mom.
Hello.
Hello, corazón. You are supposed to give me Mother's Day greetings, even though I'll see you on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm not going to make it look like I'm not seeing you on Mother's Day.
That's out of the question, booby.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson phones his mom for Mother's Day and interrupts our conversation. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you. And Floor, providing custom area rugs, runners, and wall-to-wall carpeting with Floor carpet design squares. In-store design assistance available at their store at the corner of Newbury and Clarendon. That's FLOR.com. Carpet is boring. This isn't carpet. And the Silk Road Ensemble with Yo-Yo Ma, live from Tanglewood. Don't miss this milestone performance that unites artists from more than 20 countries. Watch the Silk Road Ensemble with Yo-Yo Ma tonight at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And a couple of minutes ago, I cited a column written by business columnist for the Boston Globe, Shirley Leung. Is Deval Patrick all in casinos? Well, we're going to talk about another one. She wrote a piece today about businesses wooing women back to the office. More companies are going out of their way to get, let's call them restarters, mothers who took a work break back in the office after they've had kids or taken time away. As I said, Shirley Leung, former business editor of the Boston Globe, is now a business columnist there. Shirley, it's a pleasure to meet you, and thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Shirley. Well, this is perfect timing with Mother's Day coming up on Sunday. So many women with high-powered careers have a kid, have two kids, and say they can't manage it all, and they go back and raise their children. But there's a new development. Corporations are making strides to kind of woo them back. So explain what's happening locally.
Yeah, so I wrote a piece about a company called Reach Hire, which is a local startup. And what they do is they recruit women who, a lot of them high-level MBAs. They put them through a six-week training camp, boot camp, to kind of refresh their skills. A lot of these women have been off for 2 years, 3 years, maybe 10 years out of the workplace. And then at the end of the program, they place them at companies for 4 to 6 month paid assignments at, you know, EMC or Fidelity, Panera Bread. It's an opportunity for them to kind of see if they want to get back into the full swing of things, back into the game. It's also an opportunity for companies to take a look at them and say, do we want to hire these women eventually? And it's what I love about this company and about this story is that, you know, I feel like women are often portrayed as, you know, all we want to do is stay at home and raise kids. And when you talk to these women, they felt were incredibly hungry to work.
Right.
I mean, they're women who have MBAs. They worked for 10, 15, 20 years. They toiled to the top. And then they said, you know, I want to take a break. And then when they took their break, they realized, you know what? I really love to work just as much as I want to have kids. And it's not being that they don't love their kids. They love their kids, but I want to work and I want to get back in. And it really takes an enlightened employer to kind of look past those gaps in the resume.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Some of them don't love their kids, but that's a whole issue, another issue for another day. Shirley, you know, so that begins to address the issue on the woman who wants to return side. But there are also huge issues on the employer side. From what I've read from you and other places, some employers are worried that a woman who has left may leave again. They are concerned, as you write this morning, about resume gaps. How does one undo the bias that exists in much of the corporate world against these women who have decided to take a break?
I mean, I think this. This company and others who are kind of offering kind of temporary assignments, or there's also a term called returnships that is very popular on Wall Street. Goldman Sachs actually coined this term, and they offer 10-week internships to people who have gone on career breaks, not just women, but anybody, but largely this applies to women. And J.P. Morgan just launched one. I think MetLife just launched one. And I think by offering temporary assignments, everyone gets to take a look at each other. You know, the women are like, do I want to go back with, you know, both feet in? And the employers look at these women and say, you know what, do they still have it? And I think a lot of employers, like Fidelity, I talked to the chief technology officer of Fidelity, he was genuinely, you know, enthusiastic about, I mean, they just hired 8 women for 6 month assignments just since last fall. And he said, this group of women, they have a hunger that you don't see in other employees. They want to be back in a big way. And that comes from taking some time off and getting some perspective and realizing they want their careers back, and they bring a fresh perspective that other employees don't have who've kind of worked through and through.
Well, you know, I always say this to my friends when they're having their first baby. You know, those first few months before when the infant can't walk and can't really get around much, you know, it's very romantic and you're there and you put the kid in the stroller and you're gazing into each other's eyes. And then all of a sudden they're a 2-year-old and, you know, you're having the kids are turning into a little brat and you're chasing the kid all around the house all the time. That's when I think you really want to go back to work. But you talked about a woman in your piece who was working for a software company, PeopleSoft, traveling weeks at a time, and she took time off, which I think is a brilliant idea, when her kid was a teenager. How'd that work out, Shirley Leung?
You know, she took a big risk with her career. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't do this, but she just decided. I didn't have time to put this into my story, but she tells this great Linda Zecker, who is the CEO of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in Boston, the book publishing company. She tells this terrific story about how she was traveling all the time, and her son, who was in seventh grade at the time, and it was the weekend, and she was doing laundry, and her son comes in and chides his mother and says, "This is not how we fold clothes anymore." And that was a sign to her that my family has moved on from me. And that night, she started crying, and then she went to sleep, and then she woke up in the middle of the night and she announced to her husband, "I'm quitting my job. That's it." And so she quit the job. She moved cross country. She bought a horse farm took a break for 3 years. And then when her son got a little older, back into high school by that time, and had his own set of friends, she decided to get back into the game. And she was fortunate. She hustled and was able to find a great job at big companies right away. And now she's, she feels like it did not derail her career. That she, she got on track in the corner office now as a CEO, and her son today is 35, and she's actually a grandmother now.
Wow.
And she's saying that, to this day, her son, tells people that my mom sacrificed, gave up her great career for me. That's how much she loved me. That's how much mattered to her.
No, it's not. And I feel very guilty hearing that. I feel very guilty.
Hey, Shirley, last thing for me. Maybe what you just mentioned is an aberration. You talked about how the leave didn't derail her career. For the women who are going back through some of these returnships or whatever one calls them, are they generally put in a position where even after the transitional phase, they're forced to accept something that is of less pay and lower rank than what they had before they went home?
I mean, I think for the women I talk to, motherhood changed them and changed their attitude towards career. They may not want to be the director of marketing coming back anymore, mm-hmm. because they still want that time, the flexibility to spend time at home with their kids, to be able to meet them at the bus stop at 3:30. And so they don't mind. So they're going to make less money, and they're not going to be working as many hours. And they're fine with that, that their kids are in this. Their kids are still at home. But then I've also met other women who are empty nesters, and they want to get back into it. And I can see the empty nesters wanting to get back where they left 20 years ago.
We should point out that women who can make these decisions, obviously they're married to somebody who's making enough money that allows them to make those kind of decisions too. I mean, a lot of people are working two jobs because they can't pay the rent without it, kind of thing. So they're lucky
not
in some
a lot
ways.
Of people, right. Not a lot of people can make this decision. But what I tell people is that it's good that they bring these women back. I mean, because they become role models for everyone else, and they can also start to spread change across all ranks of the employees. Maybe bring in flexibility for all employees.
God, I hope so.
Folks at the middle management level.
Yeah, I hope so, because you feel like people are working longer and longer and longer hours, and women in the workforce hasn't done it yet. I'm hopeful it will. Yeah.
You know, I said before you go, and now I want to do one more before you go. I'm sitting back as you're just talking to Marjorie Shirley a second ago, and while we're celebrating some of these programs and the startup that's helping women get back in the workforce, isn't there a piece of both of you that says how creepy this is, for lack of a better expression, that there has to be some extra layer of something for a competent woman to get back in the workforce? I mean, wouldn't you ordinarily say, were it not for this recent history, well, they go home, they choose to take care of a kid for a year or two or three, then they go back to work. I mean, isn't that the way theoretically it should be?
I think you get mommy tracked. I don't know
what
you think, Shirley.
But that's the creepy part, isn't it, Shirley Leung?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by creepy, but I mean, when I've read surveys that surveys of highly qualified women, I mean, who stay, the average career break is about almost 3 years, yeah. and a lot of them want to come back to work, and only 40% of them can actually find full-time jobs again. So there is a mommy track,
yeah.
or there's a stigma to taking time off. And I think what's happening now is that, you know, there's kind of strength in numbers. There are so many women who have taken career breaks, very talented women, that companies are realizing, you know what, we can no longer afford to ignore this group because we have a big problem. We are losing a lot of talent. And the only way to kind of, you know, get the best people back is that we look at this pool now.
Hey, answer your question, Shirley. You know, when you said a minute ago, only 40% can find a place, you know what that is? Creepy. Hey, Shirley yeah. Leung, business columnist for The Globe. It's great to talk
yeah,
to you. Thanks
you
so much.
Yeah, great stuff, Shirley. We always love to read your stuff in The Globe. It's terrific.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Shirley Leung is a Boston Globe business columnist. Her piece today is called Mothers Being Wooed to Restart Careers. Okay, up next, Emily Rooney joins us for her world-famous list of observations and sometimes a few complaints or two. And we're also going to talk to her about Monica Lewinsky resurfacing for the 10th resurface. This time it's in Vanity Fair. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Today at WGBHnews.org, can Fido's medication for arthritis and liver disease help us mere humans as well? If you missed the pet med story on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Every year, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to land some hot deals, and every winning bid supports the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Seasons 4, for 44 years, the outdoor living store on Mass Ave in Lexington, featuring a wide selection of contemporary and traditional outdoor furniture, plus a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories. Seasons4.com. And Boston Children's Hospital, with suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close to you. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan here with us, as she is every Friday for Open Mic, is Emily Rooney. And as you know, at the end of Open Mic, she does Emily's List. Emily, tell people what you did when I attempted to glance at your Emily's List.
I flipped it right over so he didn't get it.
Exactly.
He wasn't going to cheat.
Don't
see
let
what my theme was.
And
don't
small
let him look.
And selfish. It's still turned over, yeah. by the way.
Okay, let's start with Monica Lewinsky. Monica Lewinsky is 40 years old now, and she's written a piece in Vanity Fair. A couple of beautiful pictures of Monica Lewinsky, the Monica Lewinsky at 40, the Monica Lewinsky, a younger woman when she was getting questioned by everybody from the FBI to the prosecutor, Ken Starr. So what did you make of this piece that she wrote in Vanity Fair?
I thought it was riveting. I thought I learned more about her. I thought that segment where she has a make-believe discussion with those nine women. There was these nine women sitting around a table at Le Bernardin in New York City, which is a famous good restaurant. People like Kate Roiffe and all these important feminists and everything, and they're saying the most outrageous things about
her.
And it's recorded. So Monica
this is
goes
real.
To,
well,
this
the,
is real.
Well, her being there is imaginary.
No,
lunch
actually happened, and it's all recorded. And then she goes back and interjects as if she's part of the conversation. I mean, it was unbelievable stuff. Like one of them saying, I think the thing that's really amazing or distasteful is that we think of our presidents as being godlike. And godlike people should have affairs with important people like Marilyn Monroe. And he is having an affair with this Monica Lewinsky, who I understand is not all that pretty.
Yeah, that was Katie Roiffe. I was really stunned. I was really stunned by that. I did not know about this. I thought I knew everything there was to know about the Monica Lewinsky affair.
Hillary calling her a narcissistic Looney Tune, and that surfaced in 2000 in these papers from University of Texas or something. Some woman who recorded all this stuff that Hillary had said. That woman is now dead. But as soon as that comment surfaced, Monica talks about how the paparazzis, circled her apartment building like swallows circling and pacing. And so she's never really been able to get, and how vilified she was by women.
Well, she was the feminist organized feminism totally disgraced itself during the whole affair.
Because Clinton was good on their issues.
Well, look at this. These are Erica Jong, Fear of Flying, a famous feminist writer, is part of this
lunch cabal
group that totally trashed women in a disgraceful kind of way,
saying things like, if she couldn't get a job, she can always use her mouth. Disgusting.
Disgusting things.
There are a number of people, commentators here, some of whom are credible, some of whom are not, who have written pieces or spoken pieces on television, the core of which is basically, grow up and get over this. You're 40 years old. This was 18, whatever number of years ago. We know you haven't been able to find a job. The self-pity is troubling, to say the least. What's your response to them?
I didn't have that reaction at all.
Nor did I, by the way. Nor did I. But I've heard it all. I mean, but how would you characterize Joanna Weiss's piece today in the Boston Globe?
She was sort of saying that grow up and get over it. I do think her idea that she's going to go now become the spokesperson for people that were humiliated on the internet is just not going to work. I mean, that's what I wanted to ask you about is, what do you do when you're Monica Lewinsky? I mean, what should she have done 20 years ago? Do you change your name and move to Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know, but we allow men in particular in important high places space to rehabilitate themselves.
We do. The double
Bill
standards.
Clinton,
yep.
Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, Mark Sanford. You go down the line. We have given them all space. We don't, every time they appear in public, bring up, you know, the snapshot of Weiner. Well, maybe we do that. No, we don't. The tweet we're in his underwear or whatever. No, we don't. And he was given a little bit of rope to hang himself when he ran for mayor again. Monica Lewinsky was never given that opportunity.
Well, there is a total and complete double standard here. And I think it's a lesson for your daughter, yourself, your sister, whoever, that if in this kind of situation, you are never going to recover. Mm-hmm. She points out in this piece, the other women in all these men's lives are, you know, kind of like roadkill, and they go on to have these careers. So the double standard is brutal. But what's really upsetting about it is women were as vicious toward Monica Lewinsky as men.
Maureen Dowd won a Pulitzer Prize off of dissing Monica Lewinsky. Yeah.
Well, there's also a piece we're not talking about. And again, I do have tremendous sympathy for a woman who has this trailing her everywhere she goes, can't find work, that sort of thing. The part where she writes about how this was a consensual relationship, and I'm not quarreling with the fact that she may believe it was a consensual relationship. Is there ever been a more textbook 101 case of
power imbalance?
The most powerful man in the world with an intern, with a 20-something intern.
Well, Elliot Spitzer and the hooker, that was pretty...
Well, I would say that's not even close. I mean, a hooker is a hooker. I'm not... This is a young, wide-eyed intern in the White House powerful human being on the planet.
It's crazy.
And so she, again, is out of work and out of and humiliated for 20 years, and maybe she could have done something about some part of this. And he is arguing, is he the most popular person on the planet now?
But before we leave this, what do you do? What do you do, Emily Rooney, when you're Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah.
I think you become Susie Lewin.
And you move, and by the way, I think Joanna Weiss wrote this. I think that's what she said. Was that Joanna who wrote that?
I hope so.
It's unfair, but the reality is you're never going to escape your identity and it's horribly unfair unless you do something dramatically.
But I mean, that was piling on too, and I thought Maureen Dowd piled on earlier this week. First of all, she agreed to have the drink with Monica Lewinsky, and then she went on to say about the article that Lewinsky had written, it's like listening to a golden oldie tour band again, when he didn't want to hear it in the first place. It's like, I didn't agree with that.
Well, wait a second. You said something not heard. Didn't you say when you first heard about I'm talking to Marjorie at the moment. When you saw the article the other day, didn't you say something like, we've heard from her already?
She did
Barbara Walters. Why do we need...
Well,
that was 10 years ago or 20.
I agree.
She said she hasn't given extensive interviews in 10 years, but she did do this, as she points out in this piece, almost this masochistic HBO documentary in front of all these college students who said just horrible things to her.
How does it feel to be the BJ queen?
Yeah. I mean,
I looked at that. It was awful.
So I think that's the thing with this young woman. Her parents or her lawyer or somebody should have said, it isn't fair, it isn't right, but you almost have to recreate yourself, because otherwise you will never, or go do kind of good works. I mean, work for, I don't know, battered women or something, or become a school teacher. I don't know. But she points out how she wasn't able to get jobs in most cases, because can you imagine walking in and they say, oh, the secretary greets you at the front. Monica Lewinsky's here to see Mr. So-and-so, and the entire office turns around and stares.
Mm. Well, you know what you wrote years ago, which you probably don't even remember.
I don't remember.
Is you wrote, who's the boyfriend who's going to take home Monica Lewinsky and say
parents.
To his parents, oh, by the way, I want you to meet my girlfriend, Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah,
you wrote that. You
I know did
that?
Write that.
She looks very attractive.
She's
you know.
Beautiful.
She looks great.
Great
okay,
body.
Let's talk about somebody else who at
yeah,
least some
she
people,
really is
some people
very
are suggesting
attractive.
May have to change names and move to
oh,
Steve
God.
Crosby, the chair of the Gaming yeah. Commission. I'm kidding, of course. He recused himself from the all decisions in the most important casino license award, namely Eastern Massachusetts yesterday. It was by 4-0. They decided not to give host status. That's a secondary issue right now. To Boston. What was your reaction to the whole Crosby thing?
I have to say, just first of all, I mean, I think you guys agree. This is one of the finest public servants we could ever hope for in the history
he's
of the state.
He's a very decent guy. I agree.
I mean, he's worked for both Democratic and Republican
yep.
gubernatorial administrations. He's, you know, run businesses.
He started was UMass Boston.
He started
too, for
Smart
a while.
Roots. Yeah. You know, he did. He's a classy, smart guy. Really, you know, Harvard degree, the whole thing. And as I wrote a column this week, I said, you know, he's like, if there was a position for chief common sense officer, I would have nominated him. So I think he used bad judgment by going to that Kentucky Derby / Suffolk Downs kickoff party. That was a huge mistake.
Bad judgment. True.
And then that combined with his interest with one of the owners of the parcel
in
Everett. I mean, now he's recused himself from voting on the Eastern Massachusetts license. It doesn't work. I mean,
So what does work?
I mean, I feel like eventually he's just going to be drummed out of this.
Well, was that not the implication, if not the explicit sense in the Globe editorial today? It may not be enough. I mean, particularly in light of the fact he was involved in earlier deliberations. If he's not on the commission, well, they're suggesting, I believe, that there may have to be a new chair appointed by the governor. Even though Crosby says that he decided to recuse himself on his own, I find it hard to believe that it was not the governor's criticism of his behavior
now,
by going to that thing that caused him to step back.
Now, Emily,
yes.
You are the queen, speaking of queens of things, of objecting when people are, as you put it,
totally
driven
object.
Out of town on a rail.
Yeah.
But you're suggesting that he may have to be
I think somebody
out of town on a rail?
I don't want him. I don't think he should leave, and I don't think he has to leave. But I wouldn't be surprised if you started seeing the drumbeat, probably from the Boston Globe, that he should.
You don't think he had to recuse himself at least based upon
no.
his...
No. I mean, if you're the...
No?
No. If you're the chairman of the commission, you can't recuse yourself. You're either part of it or you're
no,
not
No, I would
part
argue
of
you can't go to the Suffolk party, that you can't fail to disclose your... I understand.
That's
and when you fail in both those regards, as wonderful a person and as skilled as he is, those lapses in judgment cause you to not be able to be part of that part of the decision
making. Have you heard any scuttlebutt about this, Emily, what he was thinking about going to this party?
No, but I was at a reception the other night, and I heard this before the Globe printed it. And I was saying, I don't believe that. That can't be true.
That's what I would have said, too.
I didn't believe it.
Yeah. It seems an odd lapse on his part.
Well, apparently other chairmen have done this. It's not like, you know, other gaming people, you know, it's a tradition every year that, you know, people are involved in the gaming industry. But this is different. This is the first time we've ever been in the process of doling out billion-dollar, you know, licenses to print money.
Yeah.
You know, and there were architectural renderings on the walls. I mean, it's like... You know, you're putting yourself in a position to be influenced.
Yeah.
Well, and also people have access to you in a relaxed environment
yeah.
who have a strong point of
yes.
view on a major
right.
decision you're about to make. I think he had to recuse himself, at least from that. I don't know enough at the moment to know whether he's – and by the way, there are a lot of – not only did Marty Walsh say he had to recuse himself, there's a guy who's occasionally with us who's running for governor, Charlie Baker, months ago after the situation in Everett said he had to recuse himself. As I've said a million times, this issue –
I didn't think
Everett was
as big of a
deal. Center stage – I think it's a bigger deal. Center stage in the gubernatorial election. Before we get to Emily's list, which you will not allow me to even peek at, there's the latest Jared Remy story. Well, the one a week ago was Jared Remy writing an incredible letter to one Marjorie Egan. He's back in trouble again for throwing a full milk carton at a guard. Apparently, according to the sheriff, Peter Katujan, he is going to recommend prosecution. What was your reaction to the latest in the Remy saga?
This is just a sad and despicable situation. This guy, and he's in solitary confinement.
In solitary confinement. I didn't even know
this
they
is not
going to
end well. I mean, this is either going to be a murder in jail or a suicide. I mean, it's just it's not going to end well. I mean, I'd be shocked if he even made it to trial. It's just, I mean, I don't exactly understand what happens when you start coming down from steroids. Marjorie, you said somebody actually saw him.
Actually,
he's a shadow of him.
Laurel
himself.
Sweet from the Herald managed
great
to
reporter,
get a. She's a terrific reporter. She managed to get a great interview with Jared Remy in jail.
Yeah.
And what did she say? What did she say?
Well, she said it looked a lot smaller than he did before.
He did.
Yes, because he's not that tall to begin with. I think he's about 5'7", and he was pretty steroided up, as we say.
He looked like he weighed about 280 when he went into prison.
In those pictures, and he is much smaller than he was.
There's also a question in these kinds of situations where, nobody is expressing any sympathy for this character, an alleged murderer, in addition to an abuser for years. You wonder, I don't understand the prison system well enough, and I should find out, does he get any mental health care while he's there? If he's convicted and ultimately sentenced to life in prison without parole.
The short answer is no.
Is he just warehoused, essentially?
Because he is not in an evaluation center. He's not in Bridgewater or one of those places where you do.
No, he's awaiting trial.
So he is in solitary confinement. The answer is no.
And by the way, for those who were about the email saying another bleeding heart for a murderer, this is about protecting people around him. He was accused of assaulting a fellow inmate who's also a low-rent character and then some recently, and he attacks a prison guard. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality, again, beyond doing potential damage to himself, as you mentioned a minute ago, Emily, there's a real issue about him doing damage to guards, other people working in these prisons.
One thing I don't understand, why in the world would you prosecute him for that? I mean, he's about to go on trial for murder. And don't you go for the bigger charge? Why would you prosecute him for A and B?
I would imagine that's a deal because of the prison guards, and they don't want they want to feel that any attack on them is being taken seriously by Sheriff Peter Katushin.
Well, but there's another. I mean, I think that not only so that they have that sort of feel, but if he's not prosecuted for this, and I understand your point, then what is the incentive not to assault another prison guard tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day?
That's an awful job. That's just an awful job.
In any case, here's the moment we have all waited for. Actually, some of us wait days for this. Yes. She's turning it over as long as I can see
it. We skipped it last week.
Here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I want you to know, Marjorie, we had to skip it last week. You don't know this because you were actually in Ireland.
I was in Ireland.
We got a call from Northern Ireland.
Yeah, we did.
And as a result, Emily thought, and I think she was right, it was inappropriate at that particular time to do this. So this is make-up time for people who are in Emily's list withdrawal. Is it thematic,
Yes, it's
Emily?
Thematic.
Perfect. Take it away.
And this is an all-new list, I want you to know. I'm not carrying over my list from last week.
Oh, a lot of people were emailing asking that question.
A wasted list. You should have posted it online.
Jim and I were confessing last week while you weren't here, Marjorie, that we have some guilty pleasures that we occasionally seek out on the web.
Yeah. Ooh.
Things that we're suckers for, things we can't resist. So one of the ones we agreed upon that we can't resist clicking through any link that says you're about to look at the 25 worst celebrity facelifts.
Do you not do that? You don't do that?
No, you have an obsession with facelifts.
Okay, so this is a list of the other obsessions I have or things that I can't resist when I see it on the web that I have to click a link to.
Oh, I love this. Go ahead.
All right, so 25 worst celebrity facelifts. Got to do that. 10 most bizarre mugshots.
Oh, I've done that.
Nick Nolte always
comes up. Oh, I have
done
that.
And Kenny Rogers is on everyone.
Nick Nolte looks hysterical. His hair is sticking straight up.
All right, they're not all lowbrow.
Go ahead.
Photos of best dressed at, like, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Had to look at that one.
Sometimes.
Or the Met Gala. I looked at both of those this week.
Who was the best dressed? Do you remember?
Oh, Giselle.
Giselle.
Or who's the one with the black and white? Who was that?
I don't know. Tom Brady's mohawk. I'm not sure I'm down with the mohawk on Brady.
You know, one of our friends, by the way, speaking of his mohawk, it's not quite a mohawk. A friend of ours, Sheila, emailed a separated at birth that he looked just like Pee Wee Herman in that particular thing.
Oh, he did.
He really
that
did,
was bizarre.
Didn't he? But
yeah,
go ahead.
Now,
is that Giselle's idea or Tom's idea?
He did look like, I don't know.
All right.
I also clicked through to things like who wore it best when celebrities have the same dress.
Oh, yeah.
You can do the side-by-side comparison.
Yes.
Who wore it best.
I like that a lot.
I clicked through to any link that says inside the home of. So this week, it was inside the home of Ron Howard, who lives in Connecticut.
$27.5 million.
Did you click through it?
Yes.
It was fascinating. See, Jim and I have the same.
This is a 20-some million dollars for
little
Opie is unbelievable.
Opie. I think he lives in New Canaan. I used to run into him at the train station.
Is that true?
$22 million.
$27 million.
So what do you get for $27.5 million?
An indoor swimming pool, an indoor tennis court, about 27 acres of land on a lake.
Oh, my God.
You know, a pool room, in addition to the swimming pool room, a pool room, you know, steam bath in the master bath. I mean, it was pretty spectacular, wasn't it, Jim?
It was fabulous.
Okay.
I'm actually going to look at it again after the show.
I also clicked through Giselle Bundchen's home, which she just sold for $49 million.
I did do that.
In Brentwood.
Did you do that?
I did. I clicked through that one. All right. I clicked through to any website that takes me to baby zoo animals around the world.
I can't resist. I go through all the zoos with the newborns. And yesterday, I clicked through to the baby lion's swim test at the National Zoo. That
is
so
cute.
Oh, I
didn't see that.
They took these baby lions and threw them into this water. I thought, oh, my God, what if one of them started to drown?
They're like swimming.
Why do they do that? They want, because they have to make sure that they can swim before they release them into these, the displays.
Am I allowed to speak here? You know what one of the problems is with this, though? And I do all these same things. What drives me nuts is the sites on this list where after you click on the arrow to go to the next photograph,
it takes you
to an
ad.
I can live with that.
Oh, you have to readjust.
You have to readjust the placement of the frame.
Why is that?
You should be able to just click on the arrow again and move to the next.
Thank you so much. I have the exact same problem.
I'll say no more.
All right. This week, I also clicked through to the O.J. Simpson cast. Where are they now?
Well,
it's going to be 20 years
that's
in
a good
June.
One. Where's Darden? He was the handsome.
He's
DA.
Around. They're all still around. They're all live, including Cato Kaelin and all those people.
Ron Goldman's sister is doing an exclusive interview or something on CNN. This week.
Johnny Cochran is no longer with us.
No, he's dead. That's right. And Kardashian. He's dead.
Is Kardashian?
Yeah.
I did not
know
that.
Yeah, the Kardashian. He had a heart attack.
His name was not Kardashian. What was his name?
Yeah, Kardashian.
Was it Kardashian?
He spawned that whole family.
He was the one who was a friend who was protecting him during the whole car ride and everything.
Is he the father of Kim?
He's the father, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Mm. All right. These are two obsessions I have.
Speaking of worst celebrity faceless, Bruce Jenner's on all those
lists. No, he's on all the lists.
He's
number one. Melanie Griffith used to be beautiful.
That breaks my heart.
Butchered her face.
That breaks my heart.
I know.
You don't understand. Why, when you have as much money, is she, and she's married to that gorgeous
Is she still Antonio Banderas?
I think so.
I'm not sure
Why
about
don't
that.
You find a better
going.
Physician?
I'll work. I'm going to check it out.
I also clicked through to sites of things like 25 cheap cars that look expensive. I don't know. I like that.
Well, you're a car person.
Yeah. How about 10 soon-to-be classic cars? I'll do that. See if I have one.
What was the magazine that had you in the odd pose in the back of your father's sports
Boston,
car? Oh, Boston Common Magazine.
It wasn't an odd pose. It was a very
sexy.
I've been in a few others.
Va-va-va-voom.
All right, this one I'm sure you both do.
Yeah.
Best hamburgers.
Oh, of course.
Gotta do that.
By the way, Boston.com has that almost every day.
I know, every day. And it changes a little bit.
Yeah, what is the current best hamburger in Boston?
I don't know. It really depends on your preference.
Craigie on Main, everybody says.
Really?
It's
the best?
Absolutely. And I've had it. It is spectacular.
I think I had one there
really
once, too.
Really hungry.
Yeah.
I still like the one at the Bristol Lounge.
Oh, that's great.
It has those truffle fries.
Yeah, it's like $20, but it's really good. Really good.
All right, and finally, any link that takes me to skateboarding or surfing bulldogs. I'm a bulldog person, and they are just so cute. I could sit there.
Surfing.
Hope Phil Rado isn't listening
surfing
to what I'm
bulldogs.
He's our boss, for those who don't know.
How do
the bulldogs learn to surf?
Or skateboard. Have you seen with those little short legs, and they paddle like this, and then they get on the board, and they're rocking back? It's just amazing.
By the way, for anybody who is guesting on any of Emily's shows, if you're wondering why the tapings start late, Now we know. Hey, Emily, what are you doing on Beat the Press tonight?
Well,
you know that Mark Regan is one of your.
We are doing Monica.
Yes, I'm there. I'm so excited.
What are you doing?
Monica, and we're
Can't
looking
wait.
At how she's been treated by the press low these 20
horribly,
years.
Horribly.
And the answer is horribly.
Horribly.
I went back and looked a lot of that.
What else?
We're looking at this thing that happened after the game one of the Bruins Canadiens game about
the
alleged tweeting and all that. Turns out, everybody said it was trending through Boston, these racist comments using the N-words. Totally bogus. Didn't happen. Mm. And it wasn't happening in Boston. And then there's a really funny survey just about the status of journalists today. None of it, which is going to surprise you, but it's pretty bleak.
Yeah, we're miserable.
We're miserable.
The bottom line, especially if you're working for a newspaper. Okay,
one
Emily
of the best
Rooney.
Lists ever.
Says that every week.
That was spectacular.
That's what I love. Bye.
I think you and Jim should get together after the show and look for tiny little newborn bulldogs surfing.
That's so much to do after work.
Okay.
See you,
Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic. You can keep up with the weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2 for Greater Boston. Tonight is Beat the Press. I'm going to be with there. I'm so excited. I'm going to be with her, I should say. I'm so excited. Up next, food anthropologist and chef instructor Lily John joins us for her take on the new food. Lily Jan, excuse me. Takes for the new. Her take on the new food destination to hit Central Square. That's H Mart and the ramen rage. We're going to talk about both those things up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. Musician Meryl Garbus uses audio loops like instruments, building up layers of her own vocals in singing styles she's gathered from around the globe.
In another life, maybe I'll be an ethnomusicologist, but this is kind of my fascination with so many different types of music.
Meryl Garbus and Tune Yards on the World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com. And Boston 2034, a day-long event on June 10th showcasing ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the exponential economy in the years ahead. More at xconomy.com/Boston2034.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 as we continue this food and beer edition, it appears, of Boston Public Radio, is Lily Jen. We're going to be discussing two phenomenons in the food thing. One, the Korean market, most specifically H-Mart, which just opened in Central Square in Cambridge, and the ramen rage that is sweeping the nation. She's a chef instructor, culinary anthropologist. Lily, it's great to see you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Pleasure.
You know, let me just say before we begin this segment, Jim, that you should have planned this show better because we've been talking about food now for an hour.
I know you're dying.
I am, like, starving. We need the hot bar right now to come right to the studio and rescue us. But anyway, tell us, Lily, all about this great rage for ramen. It's like everywhere, and these very fancily prepared ramens as well.
It really is. And when you think about ramen being essentially a bowl of soup with noodles,
yeah,
the cost for some of these bowls out there is absolutely ludicrous. But I mean, you know, people are willing to pay over $100 for a burger, so why stop at a burger? But ramen is just taking over the world. But I think partly it's not a particularly complex thing. It's broth properly made and noodles well made. But if it's made right, it's so comforting, and especially on days like today where it's cold,
yes,
and rainy,
yes,
it's so satisfying. I think for a lot of people, it just hits that fatty, salty, savory flavor profile, and it's incredibly satisfying regardless of what your cultural preference is or what your diet really has.
Did this craze start we both had young kids 10, 15 years ago who, when they went away to school, when they went to college, what'd your kids eat? All they ate was 15-cent packets of ramen from the supermarket. Is that where it started and then spread to restaurants and then spread to higher end? At least in the United States, where did this explode? How did this explode?
I think in the U.S., the only reference point that people had for ramen was really those terrifying packets of crispy things that look like packing peanuts.
Right, yeah. Salt bombs.
Yeah, exactly.
I liked them, though, I must admit.
They're oddly satisfying, sort of like a greasy meal after a hangover. So, I mean, for those purposes, they were great. And then what happened was, as I think U.S. food became more diversified and really kind of explored other cultures, it became a lot more popular here. And then you had chefs like David Chang in New York of Momofuku, who really went to Japan, studied it, brought it back, and kind of Americanized it so that it became interesting and less foreign for a lot of Americans and very sexy.
By the way, if you have a favorite ramen place in and around Greater Boston, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. You can tell us what it is and why it's your favorite. Living in Cambridge, as I do, there was Sapporo Ramen, which, and we're going to talk about H-Mart, which is this huge thing opening in Central Square. It's now got a Sapporo Ramen. It used to be in Porter Square. If you went to that one and you went later than 5 o'clock, more often than not, you'd be told, I'm sorry, we're out of noodles. We can't make it.
Right.
Then another place opened down the street. I don't know if you pronounce it Yume Wo Katari. Is that how you pronounce it? I have never seen longer, more constant lines at any restaurant in my life.
Yeah.
This is generally, it's seen as an art form by this guy, a little tiny restaurant, and everybody raves. Everybody's 5 stars. You've been there, by the way?
I have, yeah. And I mean, I love the place, but it's definitely not for the faint at heart or those with a faint heart, really.
Why?
It's a lot of pork, and I mean all of the pork ever. And it's a lot of pork fat. I mean, they're very rich, very dense, very fatty noodles. And on top, you get a heaping spoonful of chopped garlic. So it's definitely a very greasy affair. And, you know, a lot of people, the style is called the Jiro Ramen. And a lot of people would suggest that you don't eat anything else that day because it's so rich and so fatty. But, I mean, people line up for things all over Asia. The best places are always the places with the longest lines. And I think Americans have always been a bit resistant to that, the lining up for food. But if it's good, it's really good and it's worth the wait every time.
What about this place in the Back Bay, this Uni, U-N-I? Mm-hmm. They have this ramen dish that's advertised in Boston Magazine. How about that place?
I've had their late night ramen. It's only available after a certain time of night on the weekends, like Friday and Saturday. And it's great. I personally, if the option between vegetable and pork, I'm always going to pick the pork.
Okay.
But I've heard really good things about the veggie ramen, and I think that there's a really great way of making it dynamic. I like the Uni late night ramen, but it's not a classic take on ramen. So for me, it doesn't hit that satisfying point.
So what's your place? What's your place?
Well, it depends what I'm in the mood for. Okay. But classic ramen, the really famous one that's kind of taken over the world, started in Sapporo. And Sapporo is kind of the headquarters of great ramen. And it's a miso-based
Square.
One. Yeah, there's one Porter Square, kind of the exchange, that random Japanese little cul-de-sac of restaurants. And then they've just opened the new one in H Mart. And that's miso-based. It's rich vegetable broth. And you don't meat broth. And you don't really know what animal they're using because it's broken down so much that all you get is rich, meaty, gelatinous, almost creamy flavor in your mouth from the soup.
It is unbelievable. Is there anything healthy about the best ramen? I mean, you mentioned, you know, noodles and a great broth, but the third ingredient, which I guess you include in the broth, there's got to be this animal fat lying on the top of the thing, does there not? In almost all of the good ramen?
Well, not if it's veggie.
Well, I understand that. But as Lily just said a minute ago, given a choice between pork and veggie, yeah. If you're really into ramen, you're going for the big time pork. It's not a terribly healthy meal, is it?
It's not terribly healthy, but then, I mean, it's not terribly unhealthy. There's generally a lot of toppings in it. There's a lot of vegetables, cabbage or bean sprouts, bamboo shoots are really common in it as well, sweet corn. So it's not the worst thing you can eat. I'm sure you could definitely do some more damage at some fast food chains around Boston.
Do you ask them to drop an egg in there? I do.
And
it is, oh my God. 877-301-8970. We're talking to Lily Jan about the ramen rage. And it's not brand new, but it really is exploding all over the place. And one of the places it's exploding is in my hometown of Cambridge. Tell people what H Mart is. There was almost, you know how like on, if you watch MSNBC and CNN and there's a presidential debate, about a week in advance they start a countdown on the clock. That's what it was like in Cambridge, waiting for H Mart to open. Tell people who are unfamiliar, it's in Burlington originally, right? People who are unfamiliar, what is H Mart, and particularly what's H Mart in Central Square?
I love H Mart, and I'm an absolute H Mart fangirl. But H Mart is essentially, it's a Korean food market. So if you took all of the best parts of Whole Foods, the beautiful packaging, the beautiful organization, the clearly labeled ingredients, and then you had all of the unusual and large variety of ingredients from an Asian market and kind of had a baby, they would have H Mart. And so they have great products that appeal to, you know, your daily home needs, but they also have Asian twists on things. So they have 15 different types of nori if you're making sushi that night and whatnot. But it's all presented in a really beautiful, very clean, very well-organized manner. And it's just great. I mean, the one in Burlington, for example, they have a huge seafood counter. And all of their seafood is labeled. They tell you if it's line caught or farm-raised. They tell you what country it's from. I mean, some grocery stores in Boston don't even have that kind of information when you ask, you know, really in-depth questions. And so it's really wonderful to have that option, especially because they have a lot more dynamic fishes. Like, they have beltfish, which looks like a cross between an eel and, like, a tuna.
Ooh.
It's crazy looking. But, I mean, it's so great because they have this variety. And so H Mart is really great for all of those Asian needs, but also they have good organic selection. They have really good diversity of vegetables and condiments and a lot of things traditionally very Asian. But I think a lot of the enthusiasm for H Mart really and truly was for the food court in Central Square.
And have you been there?
I have.
Tell us about that.
Well,
please.
I'm going to tell you something first.
Okay,
I went as a surprise shortly after it opened to get one of my daughters.
A little sleuth investigative reporting.
Sapporo Ramen to get ramen. Mm-hmm. It's her favorite place on the planet. I ordered it. I was so proud of myself. Because, by the way, you have to almost walk in sideways. It is so crowded.
Oh, yeah.
It is unbelievable. So I walk in. I have to wait in line.
Where's this? Central Square?
Central Square. I'm really proud. People have been waiting for ages for this. I am really proud of myself. I order. They finally call my number, and I find out they do not have takeout. And I had to be refunded, unlike in Porter Square. I assume that's going to change. I was too upset to even ask the question. But I assume that's – so they have a ramen place there.
Yep.
They have a curry place there. Mm-hmm. And what is the third thing, like a French –
Paris baguette, yeah.
What is up with that?
Japanese people have this wonderful tendency of taking what other people do and then making it so much better. It's very frustrating. But what they've done is they've kind of analyzed all of the best parts of a Parisian bakery. So baguettes, croissants, tartlets, and all of these things.
Oh,
and
I'm going there.
They kind of analyze it to this teeny tiny degree and try to make it the best they could possibly can. But Japanese people also have a tendency to like things slightly sweet without being sweet. So even in Tokyo, you can actually buy Oreos that are half the amount of sugar. They're delicious, by the way. But, you know, and you can get those things. So they have them slightly customized for the Japanese palate. But they're beautiful croissants, a lot of, you know, Asian takes on things. So there's like a green tea-filled muffin and croissant
ooh,
and things. And they're really great.
So they're great. Mm-hmm. But it's a pain in the neck to get to, park at,
well,
and
speaking of
enter.
That, yeah, we wanted to give a caution. By the way, we're talking to Lily Jan. And if you have a favorite ramen place or if you've been to H Mart, either, well, particularly one in the Central Square, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. A colleague of ours who shall remain unnamed sent me this email this morning. As someone who lives half a block down from H Mart, it might be useful to inform listeners that most of the surrounding parking is resident permit only, meaning you have to live in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And word on the street is that local residents are, quote, militant about having cars towed without the requisite permit. I mean, that is a problem.
So in other words, I can't go there.
Well, there are meters beyond it, but you should be prepared to spend a decent amount of time waiting for... I mean, keep in mind, the beauty of this...
How can they build places like this with no place to park?
That's a good question. Talk to the Cambridge City Council. But, you know, when I was there, and there's been an explosion of the Korean supermarket, mm-hmm. too. I mean, it's Super 88. Everybody's been going to all that sort of thing. I want to know where that comes from. When I went there, it was, I would say, 85%... kids, for the most part. I'd say millennials or younger, like late teens, early 20s. And I would say, and this actually surprised me too, maybe 85% Asian, when I went the second time, it was more mixed in terms of race, but not in so much in terms of age. What is up? Why has the Korean supermarket also become almost as hot as ramen has become? What's that about?
Well, you know, honestly, I think the Korean supermarket just, they do it right. I mean, I go to Hong Kong Market and 88 a lot, but, you know, I get a lot of complaints when I bring my non-Asian friends. It smells, not everything's labeled, nobody speaks English. It becomes very frustrating. Whereas H Mart kind of appeals to the more, I'm not familiar with this territory.
It's a crossover kind of place. That's a great point.
Yeah, and, you know, like, it's one of the cleanest places I've ever been. Have you ever been to a grocery store and you've actually seen them take out all of the fruit from a barrel and clean out the barrel and then put the fruit back?
No. You saw that at H Mart?
I've actually seen this. It was the first time in my entire life I saw that.
But you make a great point, though, because I used to work right next to Chinatown, mm-hmm. and you get down there to some of these places, and it would be kind of, what's going on in this place?
Right.
Why does it smell so weird in here?
It's not clearly labeled.
Yeah.
Things smell funny.
Yeah.
You can't really explain what you want. You
exactly.
don't know what that cut is. It can be very challenging for people who want to explore Asian foods and want to buy them
That's
so they can make
point.
Them at home, but it's just, it's so hard.
So is H Mart, where are they based? Is it an international thing, or is it a United States thing? I don't know the history of it. Do you?
They're all over the U.S. I think that they're either based in New Jersey or California or both, but they're definitely everywhere in New York and New Jersey and wherever there's a large Korean population. So definitely all over Southern California. There's a few, I think they're expanding in Northern California. But, you know, I went to New York a couple of weeks ago. I could not drive four blocks in Queens without seeing an H Mart. It was everywhere. And, you know, I was with my boyfriend who loves H Mart, and he was actually a little jealous. He was like, I want to move to Queens now. In my life, no one's ever said to me, I want to move to Queens. But there you have it.
But there's also a huge Asian population in Queens.
Absolutely.
Now, I mean,
yeah.
One of the largest concentrations of Asian, mm-hmm. probably in the United States. Is that not?
It's absolutely
true. Is that
true.
Not what it is?
Yeah. It's my birthplace.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. We're talking to Lily John about two crazes, the Korean supermarket, but particularly the ramen craze. We only have a minute or two left. And if people have a ramen connection they want to share with us, they can do that. Let's take one quick call. Neil is in Gloucester. You are next on Boston Public Radio, Neil, with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and Lily John. Hey, Neil, how are you? Or not? Oh, Neil's gone. My apologies. So you mentioned a minute ago Sapporo Ramen, and he's back. Neil, you're in Gloucester. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Neil.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
I want to tell you, I was a CDC EIS officer. Those are the guys that chase down diseases during 1983 to 85, and I was deployed to a measles outbreak on the island of Kauai during that time.
Can't wait to hear where this goes. Go ahead, Neil.
The health officer at the time was a guy of Japanese descent, and a lot of our lunchtimes and after, you know, dealing with measles and children and dealing with the outbreak itself, he would take me to his favorite ramen shop on Kauai, and we would eat ramen and drink beer. And that was also the same time that the movie Tampopo came out. and I think it's 1985, 86, it was nominated for the best foreign film of that year. And it is a feast of Japanese noodle eats. It's a kind of a campy comedy, but it's amazing. It's a
How do you spell it?
Tampopo. It's the Japanese word for dandelion.
Oh, really?
It is my number one movie. And so since that time, I've been turned on to ramen.
Ramen and
beer,
I'll tell you, Neil.
Before I rent it, I'm going to get myself a big, huge, steaming bowl of ramen with all as much pork as I can stuff on top of it because I am really
You will not be disappointed.
Starving. Lily, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. This has been absolutely great. Lily is a chef instructor and a culinary anthropologist. Up next, it is our Friday news quiz, the battle between two beer lovers. We just can't get enough food and drink today. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The Takeaway is next on WGBH Radio. John Hockenberry has news and analysis and invites us to be a part of the American conversation right here on 89.7 WGBH. Thanks for being here.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and A24 Films, presenting Locke, starring Tom Hardy as a man with one night to make a life-changing decision with reverberating consequences. He just wants to do the right thing. Now playing in select theaters. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life.
This is what listener-supported radio sounds like.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. We're going to invite you into the conversation.
In fact, 7 out of every $10 spent on daily operations here at WGBH comes from listeners.
I'll tell you, I'm in a particularly good mood today, Marjorie.
I can't really handle it myself.
89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
Public radio from Boston for New England. I'm Beth Zwick from Watertown, Massachusetts, and you and I are listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston, online at WGBHnews.org. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 for our Friday news quiz are Lauren Clark and Norman Miller. Lauren is the founder of DrinkBoston.com. She's the author of Crafty Bastards, Beer in New England from the Mayflower to Modern Day. I met her the other day at Capone's in Somerville. How are you, Lauren?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Welcome. We're glad to have you.
Thank you for coming in.
Norman is Wicked Local's beer nut blogger. He's also author of the new book, Boston Beer, A History of Brewing in the Hub. Norman, it's good to see you, too.
Thanks for having me.
Now, did you two write the same book, essentially? I mean, when I was reading reviews of both these and skimming through them today, you're talking about the history of beer in New England. You are talking about the history of beer in New England. Is that correct? I mean, it's a variation on a theme, Lauren?
Well, mine's New England.
Yeah.
And mine's all Boston only.
Oh, it is Boston only. So
okay.
So tell us about the history in Boston, Norman.
Well, Boston beer has been a huge part of Boston for years. I don't know if a lot of people realize this, but during the 1800s, they had the most breweries per capita in the country.
Boston did?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, a lot of them just took advantage of the Stony Brook and Jamaica Plain area, and they just built along it, taking advantage of the good water. And it just, you know, a lot of Irish, a lot of German, and that was part of their culture when they came here, so they wanted to continue it when they came to this country.
Did you know that Jim Cook was 125 years old?
I wasn't aware of that, Marjorie. Well, it is true. When I think of Boston beer, that's what I think of. I think of Sam Adams, and I'm just not aware until I read what you were talking about, that there was this long history here. I had no idea.
Yeah, they're actually in one of the few breweries that still stands from the 1800s. The Heffernefer Brewery,
mm-hmm.
it's the only brewery that every single one of the buildings still exists, and Sam Adams is in it.
And where is Sam Adams? I don't even know.
Jamaica Plain.
Jamaica Plain, okay.
And what's the deal in the broader universe here in New England, Lauren?
The broader universe, again, a lot of brewing going on historically throughout New England, especially in the Springfield area, in the Portsmouth, New Hampshire area. There were three major industrial era breweries in the 1800s in Portsmouth. Quite a few industrial breweries in Cranston and Providence, Rhode Island in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So,
and was everybody wiped out both in Boston and broader New England by Prohibition? I mean, is that, what did that do for the breweries, or did they just go underground?
Yeah, it pretty much killed them. And beer is a pretty bulky product to carry around in secret. So,
how'd you get into this?
Well, I used to be a brewer. I brewed professionally for a couple of years in Cambridge at the Cambridge Brewing Company.
Okay.
And then I wrote about beer for some of the trade beer newspapers.
And how about you, Norman?
Well, I just started drinking beer when I worked up in New Hampshire, and I was just fascinated by how craft beer was so much different than what I was exposed to before that. You know, everyone, when they first start drinking beers, Budweiser, Miller, and Coors.
Yeah.
And then when I started drinking other beers, there was a beer called Drunken Monkey Barley Wine. And
oh,
all
my
these
gosh.
Different beers, and it just got me really fascinated. I started reading as much as I could, go to a liquor store, buy like six different beers that I never heard of, and just intellectually got stimulated by trying all these different beers and seeing how this all came together.
I've got a ton of questions, but we should start the quiz, and we can intersperse questions amidst the questions. Who do you want to start with, Marguerite?
I want to do girl, boy.
Do a girl kind of thing.
Okay, Lauren, you ready?
Sure.
Okay, what star-studded DC event took place last weekend? Here is a hint from Jimmy Fallon.
Of course, this weekend was the and during his speech on Saturday, President Obama made fun of his low poll numbers, the botched Obamacare rollout, and Governor Chris Christie. While I was on the phone with Putin negotiating a ceasefire in Ukraine. I mean, because if he's going to do my job.
Okay, do you know what event it was? It took place last weekend in Washington, D.C. with lots of stars.
The White House Correspondents'
Dinner. That is correct. Okay, you
total
are on the board,
by
Lauren.
The way,
very, that's right. Very good.
Okay, Norman, here's your opportunity to tie things up. A former handbag seller and London School of Economics grad made waves this week with a Vanity Fair piece she wrote. Tell us who it is on the other side of this clip.
Describing herself in a Vanity Fair article as, quote, possibly the first person whose global humiliation was driven by the internet. Republican conspiracy theorists like Lynn Cheney are questioning the timing of the article, however, suggesting that Hillary Clinton orchestrated its release to build sympathy ahead of her 2016 run, which makes sense because is in no doubt looking for ways to help the Clintons after all they did for her.
Okay, and who would that be about? Who did the Vanity Fair piece?
Monica Lewinsky.
Without missing a beat, that is exactly right.
Yeah, poor Monica. It's not been an easy road these last few years. Okay, you ready for another one, Lauren?
I'm ready.
What Boston native was unceremoniously banned from Hard Rock casinos recently? Here's a hint.
This may be the last photo you ever see of gambling in Vegas, because he was just banned from a casino for doing this.
So you want a hit. So you have 18.
By which we mean he was counting cards.
I'd like to know who that announcer is. Forget who got banned from Las Vegas. Do you have any idea who it is?
I have no idea who it is. I'm not even going to guess.
Little bit of a hint before you. Well, actually, it's all only fair. Go ahead, Norman. Do you know who it is?
Ben Affleck.
It is
very
Ben
good.
Affleck.
Very good. You know, I wasn't here last week because I went to Ireland for the first time in my life, and I went to the Guinness factory over there where they make the beer. And I don't like Guinness normally. It's too heavy for me. But it is amazing how when you actually go there and you drink it right after it's made, it's a completely different experience.
Look at the smiles on both their faces as you're speaking,
by the way. So I assume that's generally true about beer. It's one thing if it's been carted halfway across the country or the world. Another thing if it's fresh.
Yeah, you 90% of the time you want it fresh.
Yeah. And where can you get fresh beer except for...
I go to Ireland.
But you have to go to a local brewery.
Well, aren't there a ton of local breweries? You and I, when we met the other day, we're talking... What's the name of the joint in Framingham that is brewing?
Jack's Abbey. Yeah.
Jack's Abbey. I haven't been there. I've just had their beer. It is fabulous. If you go there, I assume you can have fairly freshly brewed beer,
yes.
No?
Yes, absolutely.
I go there every week. I work in Framingham, and they put new stuff on tap 3 or 4 times a week because they have so many people going there, and they have it... Brewery-only specials. You could buy beer by the half gallon and bring it home and share with people.
Norman, if you didn't have a bias, Norman Miller is the host, is the author of Boston Beer, and Lauren Clark is the author of Crafty Bastards, also about beer's history. Where, if you weren't didn't have a bias, where would Boston and New England rank in terms of the quality of beer brewed in this region? Nationally, I mean, if people said, well, when looking at the United States, Boston and New England, they are really blank. What are they?
I think it's really growing. I mean, you still hear about the West Coast, San Diego area being the top area, but New England really is jumping up. I mean, you look at, there's a brewery in Vermont, Hill Farmstead, that's universally right now on beer rating websites, the number one brewery in the world.
Would you agree with that, that New England is hot in terms of the beer world?
New England is hot, and also in Vermont, The Alchemist is rated in you know, in the top one or two breweries in the world as well.
Really?
So, yep.
Where in Vermont?
The Alchemist is in Waterbury. And,
wow.
Yeah, Hill Farmstead is Greenboro, I think.
I think so. I'm drawing a blank on it, but they... It's basically just you only can get it if you visit the brewery or on draft at certain bars.
Well, that's pretty great, actually. Okay, Norman, here's your opportunity. Oh, you're actually 1 point ahead because you stole a question. You can have a 2 point lead if you get this right. What Fox TV series returned this week for a limited run? Here's a hint with the main actor's name bleeped out.
The newly invented will feature 12 episodes of saving the world nearly single-handedly, as he did in the prior 192 episodes. Except this time, he gets an extra hour of rest between episodes due to time jumps, stretching the grueling hours of acting from 12 to 24. Come on, face it. A man can get beat up that badly for only so long before needing a break.
And what would the answer to that, Norman Miller, please? You know who that is?
Yeah, 24, Kiefer Sutherland.
That is exactly right, reprising his role as Jack Bauer. My favorite story about Jack Bauer is Marjorie and I would interview people in our former lives who were anti-terror people, people who were concerned that the government was spying on people. And what was their favorite show? 24. And what did they love most about 24? When Jack Bauer was torturing somebody.
I know, it was terrible.
It was like this incredible vicarious thing. So it's 3-1, Norman Miller.
He shot some woman in the thigh right in the middle of an episode. A woman in the thigh. It was disgusting. Okay,
cool.
You ready, Lauren? I know, and I tuned in every week for another episode of people shooting him someplace, people shooting, getting shot someplace else. Anyway, what NBA star won the MVP this year? Here is a clip from the ceremony.
To the citizens of Oklahoma City, to the great fans here tonight, and to an all-star group of teammates, member of the Oklahoma City Thunder, you are the NBA Kia Most Valuable Player. Congratulations.
Are you a basketball fan?
I'm a Celtics fan.
You're a Celtics fan.
No Celtic won it. Let me just
I never heard of this guy.
Are you kidding me?
I don't follow. You know
so that means, Lauren, you do not know who it is. Is that a safe assumption?
It's a pretty safe assumption.
And Norman, what's the deal? Do you have any idea who this is?
Yes, Kevin Durant.
Now, let me just tell you why you should know who he is, and I will address this to Lauren and Marjorie.
Okay, tell
His acceptance speech is one of the most beautiful things ever spoken by an athlete.
Wow.
Thanking his mother in the most moving way about, he talks about, wish we had sound from it, who talks about how when there wasn't enough food for the whole family, his mother would make sure that he and I think his one sibling ate, even though she would not on that particular day. Talking about his teammate is the most generous,
beautiful
speech I've ever heard by an especially comparing it to the guy who usually wins the award, which is who is LeBron James, who is totally full of himself.
Okay, I'll go Google it, Jim.
Okay, fine. Now, are we going to go to the, do we have a lightning round this week, judges, or we do? We do. Okay, let's do one more question here, Marjorie, to Lauren.
Okay, Lauren, here we go.
Oh, no, wait a second. That was just to her.
That was Lauren.
My apologies to you, Norman Miller. Again, Norman Miller is the author of Boston Beer, History of Brewing in the Hub. And Lauren Clark is the author of Crafty Bastards, Beer in New England, From the Mayflower to Modern Day. What popular sports drink, Norman Miller, will change its formula? Listen to this news clip about it.
Coca-Cola is changing one of its sports drinks after a teenager took them to task. Will no longer contain the ingredient brominated vegetable oil, or BVO, which is also found in some flame retardants and linked to health problems when consumed in large amounts. The ingredient is already banned in Japan and the European Union, and it wasn't until a teen in Mississippi started a petition on change.org that the ingredient got attention in the U.S.
Now, I want to editorialize before you answer this, Norman Mailer. I don't even like a drink unless it contains some flame retardant in it. How about, is that, okay, what is the drink that has changed its ingredients this week, Norman Miller?
Gatorade?
Does that count, judges? It does not. I will say it is close, Lauren. Do you have any idea what the drink is? It is not brewed at any, you have no idea?
Red Bull.
No, Red Bull is an excellent guess. It would be wrong. And the answer is Powerade, whatever Powerade is. We're sorry that is not correct. What is the score after three round judges? Can you share that with us, please? 4-1 in favor of Norman. But I want you to know, Lauren, the rules have changed seconds ago. Every question is worth triple its usual amount. So next question for
Lauren. Before we go, do you guys have favorite, your very, very favorite beer?
That's like asking a wine lover what their favorite wine is.
Okay, so there's a lot of good beers.
Ask her anyway. She's our guest. Go ahead.
Well, give us a couple.
Well, right now I have really been enjoying Jack's Abbey's flagship beer, which is Jabby Brow.
And where do you go to get that?
You can get it at stores all around Boston and Massachusetts and probably some other parts of New England.
Again,
as well.
Brewed in Framingham, brewed in Framingham. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I was born in Framingham, so
I'm
biased.
Well, there you go.
And how about you, Norman?
Actually, I have to say one of them's Jack's Abbey's Hoponius Union, their India Pale Lager. I drink that a lot. I mean, that's one of my go-to beers.
Two votes.
So you have to
Jack's
drive
Abbey.
To Framingham, or you can buy it like at your local liquor store.
You can buy it at your local liquor store.
But it's better if you get it in Framingham at the brewery.
They get it out really quick
because
they concentrate almost all in Massachusetts, except for a small area in New York.
Okay.
So
I would notice a difference if I went and bought that.
You know, by the way, I'm pretty much in the same boat as both of them. If you ask me, Bud Light, I would say, is really. It's not. Okay. Here's one more question. Ask a question. This is worth 3 points. You can tie this up right here, Lauren Clark. Let's go to question number 7 on the original sheet, Marjorie.
Okay. Dr. Dre could become the richest rapper on the Forbes list if his Beats music company gets sold. So, do you know who's interested in buying Beats?
Apple is reportedly in talks to acquire headphone maker Beats Electronics for the princely sum of $3.2 billion. According to the Financial Times, looking to snag Beats to inject a bit of cool into their brand and to take advantage of the company's burgeoning music subscription service, an area of the music market has been unable to break into.
That would be Apple.
That is correct.
So it is tied because, again, coincidentally, that was worth 3 points. Now, here's the final question. If you get this right, Norman, you win.
Okay.
If you get it wrong, we're giving all the points to Lauren.
Okay.
So here it is. You ready?
Yes.
What distinction did a New York resident recently achieve? Here's Letterman. That it would be David Letterman, of course, talking about that distinction.
You know what I heard today? There's a guy in New York City on the Upper West Side. He's 111 years old, lives right here in New York City. Yeah. How about that? 111. His health care, his medical expenses are fully covered by Coolidge Care.
Okay, what distinction did he achieve to win all the marbles, Norman Miller?
Oldest U.S. citizen?
Boy, that is really close, but not exactly right. How about it, Lauren? Do you want to steal the question?
Was he the last World War I vet?
That is an excellent answer. They are both wrong. We end in a tie. Congratulations. At 111, he's the world's oldest living person.
Wow.
Hey, before you guys go, tell us one tip about beer selection from each of you before you go. Lauren Clark, starting with you. What's a tip for the uninitiated? People really want to get good stuff, but stuff that fits their likes, their palate. What's a tip for them?
Buy as local as possible.
Because it's fresh? Is that the deal?
How do you tell?
Well, you can look at the label and see where it's brewed. And
that's a good way to find out.
Whatever town
you're
in. So
it will say right on there.
Yeah, and often they have freshness dating, so you can make sure, you can know when it was brewed.
And Norman Miller, how about you quickly?
Talk to the beer manager in the store. I mean, they a lot of stores are having beer-specific people. They might be able to give you advice. You tell them, I like this beer. What other beers are similar to this? And it's a good way to find other beers that are similar to what you like.
Fair enough. That was the voice of Norman Miller. He's the author of Boston Beer, A History of Brewing in the Hub. The other voice was that of Lauren Clark. Crafty Bastards is her book, Beer New England, From the Mayflower to Modern Day. Thank you both for your time. We appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. On Monday, our political roundup and food writer Michael Pollan will also be here.
And we want to mention something, especially Marjorie and I are both going to be at a march in Dorchester on Sunday. It's the Mother's Day Walk for Peace, organized by families who have lost someone they love to violence, usually gun violence. If you go to Mother's Day Walk for, the number 4, peace.org, you can find about it. It's a terrific day. Actually, believe it or not, it's a real upbeat celebration of the lives of these wonderful people. We hope to see you there.
It absolutely is. Thank you to Chelsea, Will, Amanda, and Alan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Please tune in again on Monday. Thanks for listening today.